in Lyra's chest, still turning the sun to a dull red ember and smudging away the sky, kept Lyra from crying too. Haven. Gone. They were outside the fence. They were in thin, unbound air in a world of alligators and humans who hated and despised them. They were running away from safety, and Lyra didn't know why. Only that the guard had come at her with a gun, looking as if he wanted to shoot. Why had he drawn his gun? The guards were there for their own protection, to keep the outside world out, to keep the replicas safe. The mosquitoes, at least, had been chased off by the smoke, although no-see-ums were still hovering in swarms over the water, and Lyra got some in her nose and mouth and even beneath her eyelids. From here, the sound of the fire was strangely musical and sounded like the steady roar of a heavy rain. But the sky was green-tinged and terrible, and the ash floated down on them. Her arms were shaking from trying to keep Cassiopeia on her feet. Even the pillowcase felt impossibly heavy. Cassiopeia was clinging so tightly to her neck, Lyra could hardly breathe. Cassiopeia was passing in and out of consciousness, and Lyra imagined her mind like a series of ever-branching tunnels, like the marshland crisscrossed by fine veins of water, going dark and then light again. "How much farther?" speaking hurt. 72 just shook his head. She knew that human men were in general stronger than women and wondered whether the same thing was true of replicas. He looked strong. The muscles of his back and shoulders stood out, though he couldn't have been eating well since he escaped. She wondered where he'd gotten his food. She wondered why he'd been so desperate to get out and whether he knew something she didn't, or maybe he was just crazy. Plenty of replicas had lost their minds before, like how Lilac Springs had lost her mind during her examinations, had forgotten all the numbers she was supposed to remember. There was Pepper, who'd used a knife to open her wrists, and number 220, who'd simply stopped eating, and number 35, who'd started believing she was one of the rats and would only crawl on all fours. Maybe 72 was like that. Maybe he believed he was an animal and should roam free. She couldn't go on anymore. Cassiopeia was too heavy. Every breath felt like it was hitching on a giant hook in her chest. She tried to call out to 72, but realized she didn't have the energy even for that. Instead, she struggled with Cassiopeia into the reeds, finding footing on the muddy banks that stretched like fingers through the water, until the ground solidified and she could sit. 72 had to double back when he realized she was no longer behind him. "We aren't safe here," 72 said. He didn't sound like he'd lost his mind. She noticed how dark his eyes were, so they appeared to absorb light instead of reflecting it. "I should leave you," he said after a minute. "So leave," she said. But he didn't. He began forcing his way through the reeds, snapping them in half with his hands when they resisted too strongly. The grass was so high and thick here it cut the sky into pieces. "Lie down," he instructed her, and she did. Cassiopeia was already stretched out in the mud, lips blue, eyes closed, and that sick animal smell coming off her, like the smell in the funeral home that no amount of detergent and bleach could conceal. Lyra could see now the glint of something metal wedged in her back, lodged deep. The muscle was visible, raw and pulsing with blood. Instinctively, she brought a hand to the wound, but Cassiopeia cried out as if she'd been scalded, and Lyra pulled away, her hand wet with Cassiopeia's blood. She didn't know how to make the bleeding stop. She realized she didn't know how to do anything here in this unbound outside world. She'd never eaten except in the mess hall. She'd never slept without a nurse ordering lights out. She would never survive. Why had she followed the mail? But someone would come for her. Someone must. One of the doctors would find her and they would be saved. This was all a mistake, a terrible mistake. Lyra squeezed her eyes shut and saw tiny explosions, silhouettes of flame drifting above Haven. She opened her eyes again. Cassiopeia moaned and Lyra touched her forehead, as Dr. O'Donnell had once done for her. Thinking of Dr. O'Donnell made her breath hitch in her chest. There was no explanation for that feeling either. None that she knew of, anyway. Cassiopeia moaned again.
Shh,
Lyra said. It's all right.
It's going to die,
72 said flatly. Luckily, Cassiopeia didn't hear, or if she did, she was too sick to react.
It's a she,
Lyra said.
She's going to die, then.
Someone will come for us.
She'll die that way, too, but slower.
Stop, she told him, and he shrugged and turned away. She moved a little closer to Cassiopeia.
Want to hear a story?
She whispered. Cassiopeia didn't answer, but Lyra charged on anyway. Once upon a time, there was a girl named Matilda. She was really smart, smarter than either of her parents, who were awful. Matilda was one of the first long books that Dr. O'Donnell had ever read to her. She closed her eyes again and made herself focus. Once again, she saw fire, but she forced the smoke into the shape of different letters, into words floating in the sky. Extraordinary. In the distance, she heard a mechanical whirring, the sound of the air being threshed into waves, helicopters. Her dad was a used car salesman. He liked to cheat people. Her mom just watched TV.
Safe,
she thought, picturing the word pinned to clouds. Matilda liked to read.
What is that?
72 asked in a low voice, as if he was scared of being overheard, but he sounded angry again. It's a story, she said.
But...
He shook his head. She could see sand stuck to his lower lip and dust patterning his cheekbones.
What is it?
It's a book, she said. It's called Matilda. And then, though she had never admitted it to anyone, one of the doctors read it to me.
72 frowned again. You're lying, he said, but uncertainly, as if he wasn't sure.
I'm not, she said.
72, she'd decided, was very ugly.
His forehead was too large and his eyebrows too thick. They looked like dark caterpillars. His mouth, on the other hand, looked like a girl's. I have a book here. Dr. O'Donnell gave it to me. But all the breath went out of her lungs. She had reached into the pillowcase and found nothing. Nothing but the file folder and the pen. The book was gone.
I don't believe you, 72 said. You don't know how to read, and the doctors would never...
He broke off, suddenly angling his head to the sky.
I don't care whether you believe me or not,
she said. The book was gone. She was suddenly freezing. She wondered whether she should go back for it.
I had it right here. It was here.
Quiet, he said, holding up a hand.
I need that book,
she felt like screaming.
Dr. O'Donnell gave it to me so I could practice.
But this time he brought a hand to her mouth and pulled her into him as she kicked out and shouted into his palm. She felt his warm breath against her ear.
Please,
he whispered. The fact that he said please stilled her. No one said please, not to the replicas.
Be quiet.
Even when she stopped struggling, he kept her pinned to him, breathing hard into her ear. She could feel his heart through her back. His hand tasted like the mud of the marshes, like salt, sweat collected between their bodies, insects whined. Now the air was being segmented, cut into pulsing rhythms as if mimicking a heartbeat. The helicopters were getting closer. The sound became so loud she wanted to cover her ears. Now a wind was sweeping across the marshes, flattening the grass, driving up mud that splattered her legs and face, and just as the sound reached an unbearable crescendo, she thought 72 shouted something. He leaned into her. He was on top of her, shielding her from a roar of noise and wind. And then he relaxed his hold, and she saw a dozen helicopters sweep away across the marshes toward the ruins of Haven. Inside them and hanging from the open helicopter doors were helmeted men wearing drab brown and gray camouflage. She recognized them as soldiers. All of them had guns. Lyra, Cassiopeia, and 72 lay in tense silence. Several helicopters went and returned.
Lyra wondered whether they were bearing away the injured like they'd done for the man who lost his leg to an alligator, who lay screaming in the darkness while the guards lit up the water with bullets. Every time one of the helicopters passed overhead, she was tempted to reveal herself, to throw up an arm or stand up out of the long grass and the knotted trees and wave. But every time she was stopped, as though by an enormous, invisible hand, frozen on the ground where she was. It was the way they churned the air to sound that made her teeth ache. It was the memory of the guard with his gun drawn, shouting at her. It was 72 lying next to her. For a long time in the lulls, they could still hear men shouting and the roar and crackle of the fire blazing on the island. Voices hung in the ashy haze were carried by it like a bad smell. After a while, however, Lyra thought the fire must have stopped because she could no longer hear people yelling. At the same time, she realized that she could hardly see. The sky, which for hours had been the textured gray of pencil lead, was now dark. The sun was setting, and the wind, when it hissed into life, carried a heavy chill. The rain swept in next, the thunderstorms that always came in the early evening, quick and ferocious, punching down on them. By the time it had passed, the sun was gone. Cassiopeia was completely still. Lyra was afraid to touch her and find she was dead, but when she did, she felt a pulse. Periodically, the sky was lit up with helicopters passing back and forth, and every so often, a shout carried over the water. Lyra thought of her small, clean bed under the third window in the dorm and had to swallow back the urge to cry again. She wouldn't have thought she could be so cold and so afraid and also have to fight so hard against sleep. At some point she must have drifted off because she woke from a nightmare of monsters with long metal snouts and felt 72 put a hand against her mouth again and lean his weight against her to speak into her ear. "They're searching the marshes," 72 whispered. "Stay quiet. Don't move. Don't even breathe." Her heart was still racing from the nightmare. It was so dark she could hardly make out Cassiopeia lying even a few feet away. But after a second she saw light flashing through the tall grass, tiny suns blazing and being drowned. She heard voices, too, not the panicked and indistinct shouting of earlier, but individual voices and words. "Over here! That's blood, boys!"
"Christ, like a slug trail. You bring any salt?"
She was afraid. Why was she afraid? She didn't know. She wasn't thinking clearly. The guards were on her side. They had kept the others out. They kept the replicas safe. But still fear had its hand down her throat. This was her chance to change her mind, to call out, to be rescued. 72 shifted next to her, and she stayed silent.
"Here's one."
One of the men raised the cry and lights flashed again, dazzling over the dark water as several other soldiers joined him where he stood. She wanted so badly to look. But even as she started to raise herself onto her elbow, 72 jerked her back to the ground.
"Stay put,"
he whispered. She heard laughter from the soldiers, more words half blown by wind.
"Bring up. No point. Dead. No bodies. Left. It looks real, doesn't it?"
Lyra was filled with a cold so deep it felt like a pit. "It looks real, doesn't it?" She knew they'd found another replica, a dead one, and wondered what she would look like to them if they came across her with their flashlights. Like something mechanical, a machine, or like a doll with moving parts. She imagined herself like a jigsaw puzzle. She had seen one, once, in the nurse's break room. Well-crafted, neatly jointed, but full of seams and cracks visible to everyone else. She wondered whether humans had some invisible quality, the truly critical one she'd never be able to replicate. They were coming closer, slowing through the water. Now she couldn't have cried out even if she wanted to. Her lungs had seized in her chest. She had to grind her teeth to keep them from chattering.
"More blood over here, see?"
Lyra's heart stopped. The men were just on the other side of the embankment. Their flashlights slanted through the grass. Were they well enough concealed? Would they be seen?
"Keep an eye out for gators. These marshes are crawling. Maybe we should give Johnson up for bait."
More laughter. Lyra squeezed her eyes shut. "Move on," she thought.
Still uncertain whether this was the right thing, all she knew was that she didn't want them to see her. They couldn't see her. Move on. Then there was a horrible sucking, gasping noise, like water fighting through a stuck drain. For one confused second, Lyra couldn't tell where it was coming from. Then she realized Cassiopeia was trying to speak. Help! The word was mangled, distorted by the sound of liquid in her lungs. No, Cassiopeia! Lyra whispered, dizzy now with panic. But already she knew it was too late. The soldiers had gone silent. Cassiopeia spoke a little louder. Help! In here! One of the men was already crashing through the trees toward them, and the marshes were once again alive with lights and shouting. There's someone in here! Leave her! Leave her! 72's voice, when he whispered, was raw with panic. This time Lyra didn't resist, didn't even argue. 72 was going elbow over elbow into the tangle of growth. She crawled after him as fast as she could on her stomach. The ground trembled under the weight of the soldier's boots as she fought deeper into the growth. Pine needles grabbed her face and arms and scored tiny cuts in her skin. She was too scared to look back. She was certain they would be heard, crashing through the grass. But the soldiers were loud, calling to one another in a rapid patter she didn't understand. Then the trees released them into a heavy slick of puddled mud and water. They'd reached another sudden opening in the land, a place where the marsh became liquid. 72 slid into the water first, and Lyra pulled herself in next to him, just as a beam of light swept over the bank where she'd been. She slipped down to her chin, gasping a little, certain they must have heard her, and then submerged herself to her eyes. The beam of the light continued sniffing along the mud like something alive. 12 inches from her, then 10. There's a trail here, one of the men called out, crashing through the growth, kicking aside the spindly branches lit up by his flashlight. Lyra knew they were finished. Looks like something crawled out this way. The light inched closer, touching the water now so close to her nose she drew back. Found it! The light froze where it was. If it had truly been an animal, it would have been close enough to lick her. Then the soldier on the bank turned and retreated in the other direction. Dead or alive? What the fuck alive? Doesn't look like it. How many were there? 3? 4? It was so hard to tell how many were out there in the marshes with their lights and boots and heavy guns. Cassiopeia spoke up one more time faintly now. Help me. Oh, Jesus Christ, there's blood all over the place. It got a bullet in the back or something. Might as well put a bullet in the front, too. No way it's going to make it all the way to base. Are you kidding? You know how expensive these things are to make. Might as well take a dump on 100 grand. Beneath the surface, something slick and heavy brushed Lyra's arm, and she stifled a scream. She wondered if even now there were alligators circling them in the dark, or snakes with sleek, black bodies and poisonous fangs. High above them, the stars glittered coldly in a perfectly clear sky. Damn it. All right, then. On 3? You're kidding, right? It's bleeding. That's how it spreads. Not unless you eat them, you dumb shit. What's the matter? You hungry? More laughter. There were definitely 3 of them. At least 3. For the first time in her life, something black and deep and hateful stretched out of Lyra's stomach. She hated them. She hated that they could laugh and that they were afraid to touch Cassiopeia. She hated their easy way of talking. She hated that she could look like a human and yet she was not a human, and they could tell. But just as quickly as it had come, the hatred passed. She was cold and tired and scared. She had no energy to be angry, too. At least the soldiers were going and leaving Cassiopeia behind after all. It's already dead, one of them said. See? Let one of the cleanup crews get to it tomorrow. There was the sound of a boot against a body, several hard thumps. Lyra sank down another inch in the water as if she could flood the sound from her ears. If there were alligators in the water, they could chew off her feet and she wouldn't notice. Or maybe her feet were already gone. Maybe the pain had numbed her. The idea was so awful it struck her as funny. She might be standing there on 2 stumps, bleeding out into the swamp like Cassiopeia. It's all right. They're gone now. In the darkness, 72's features were softened. Then she realized she'd been laughing out loud, laughing and shivering. The men were gone.
The marshes were silent and still except for another helicopter that took off in the distance and swept out toward Barrel Key. She waded out of the water, after him, slipping on the mud. "What if they come back?" she asked, through the hard freeze in her chest. She knew it couldn't really be cold. 72 didn't seem cold at all, and the nurses had been complaining only yesterday about the awful heat. The cold must have somehow been inside, lodged in her chest like the piece of metal that got Cassiopeia in the back. She wanted to go and look at Cassiopeia to make sure she was really dead, but she was so tired. "They won't be back," he said. "They'll finish searching the marshes, but they won't come back, not for a while at least. Lie down," he said. And she did, so tired that she didn't even pull away when he lay down next to her. Already she was half asleep, drowning in a tangled liquid dream. But when he put his arms around her, she jerked briefly awake. "The human body," he said without letting go of her, his voice low and sleepy, "is full of nerve cells." "I know," she said reassured. 10 trillion of them." She was asleep again, and dreaming of 10 trillion nerves lighting up like stars against a blood-red, pulsing sky. Lyra, Chapter 9. She woke up warm, sweating, from a dream she couldn't remember. The smell of smoke was fainter now. Her cheek was crusty with mud. The shock of what had happened had passed. She knew immediately where she was, but not what had woken her. But something had woken her. She sat up, wondering what time it was. Her body ached. She knew from the darkness it must still be the middle of the night. Beside her, 72 was sleeping with both hands folded beneath his head and his mouth open. He looked much younger when he slept. Even before she heard a footstep, she knew that someone was nearby and that this, the sound of someone close, was what had woken her. She took hold of 72's arm, and he came awake at the same time she heard a girl speak. "What now?" she said. "Do you think we can still get..." But she abruptly fell silent, and Lyra realized she had made a sound without meaning to. They must be more soldiers sent to comb the marshes, and yet the girl didn't speak like a soldier and wasn't moving like one either, with a fearlessness born from their guns. These people, she had no doubt they were people and not replicas, were doing their best to stay quiet, almost as if they too were afraid of being seen. Who were they? What did they want? 72 was alert now, listening. The people, whoever they were, seemed to be just on the other side of the misshapen trees that grew all through the marshes. "Nurse, don't even think about it," had said they were bad luck. Lyra and 72 had to move. She shifted into a crouch, and a twig snapped beneath her weight. "Don't move," 72 whispered. "Don't move." But it was too late. She heard crashing in the brush. In the darkness, all the sounds were confused, and she didn't know what had happened and whether they'd been found. "Who's there?" 72 called out, but no one answered. Lyra stood up and plunged blindly in one direction, sliding a little on the mud, her own breath harsh and alien-sounding. Pain ripped through her heel where she stepped. The marshes were full of toothy things, plants and animals that bit back, a world of things that only wanted to draw blood, and for a second she was aware of the stars infinitely high above her, the distance and coldness of them, a long, dark plunge into emptiness. There was nowhere to go, nowhere to run. In the world outside Haven, she was nothing, had no past and no future. Shadows moved on her left. Something heavy hit the ground, and the girl cried out. Lyra froze. She'd run in exactly the wrong direction, straight toward the strangers and not away from them. "Jesus! Jesus Christ!" "That voice!" the girl spoke again. "Where did it come from?"
"I don't know. Christ, Gemma, look!"
Lyra heard coughing as if someone was trying not to throw up. This, the evidence of side effects, calmed her. Maybe she'd been wrong. Maybe these were replicas who'd somehow escaped the way she did. She inched forward, parting the tangle of grasses with a hand, until she saw a boy silhouetted in the moonlight, his hand to his mouth, and the girl crouching beside him, whimpering. "What the hell? What the hell?" he kept saying.
The moon broke loose of the clouds and clarified their features. Forgetting to be afraid, Lyra went forward. "Cassiopeia?" she said, because she was confused, still half in shock. Of course the girl couldn't be Cassiopeia, just like it couldn't be any of her genotypes, 7 through 10. Cassiopeia was dead, and her genotypes didn't have soft brown hair, soft everything, a pretty roundness to their faces and bodies. Lyra stopped again, seeing in the grass next to the girl the body, the slender ankles and familiar wristband, the blood darkening her shirt. Cassiopeia. And yet the girl crouching next to her had Cassiopeia's face and round little nose and freckles. A genotype, then, like Calliope and Goose Down and Tide and Charmin, but one that Lyra didn't know. Were replicas made in other places, too? It was the only thing she could think of that made sense. The boy stumbled backward as if he was afraid Lyra might attack him. The girl, Cassiopeia's replica, identical to her except for the extra weight she carried and the hair that grazed her shoulders, was staring at Lyra, mouth open as though she was trying to scream but couldn't. Finally, Cassiopeia's replica said, "Oh my God, I think she's one of them." "Who are you?" Lyra managed to say. "Where did you come from?"
"Who are you?"
The boy had a nice face, geometric, and she found it easy to look at him. "Lyra," she said, because she decided there was no point in lying. "Number 24, she clarified, because wherever they came from, they must have number systems too. But they just stared at her blankly. She couldn't understand it. She felt as she had when she had first started to read. Staring at the cipher of the letters, those spiky, evil things that kept their meaning locked away. "Oh my God!" The girl brought a hand to her mouth. "There's another one!" Lyra turned and saw 72 edging out into the open, holding a knife. He must have stolen it from the kitchen before escaping, and she doubted it was very sharp, but the strangers didn't know that. Now the boy had both hands out. Lyra thought he looked nervous. For a split second, he reminded her of the nurses, and the narrow way they looked at the replicas, and she almost hoped that 72 would hurt him.
"Look," he said. He wet his bottom lip with his tongue. "Hold on a second. Just hold on. Who are you?"
72 came to stand next to Lyra. She couldn't tell what he was thinking. His face, so open in sleep, had closed again, and she had never learned how to read other people's moods and feelings, had never been taught to.
"We're nobody,"
the boy said. Slowly he helped the girl to her feet. She was wearing normal clothing, Lyra noticed. People clothing. She understood less than ever.
"Listen, we're not going to hurt you, okay? My name's Jake Witz. This is Gemma. We got lost in the marshes, that's all."
Lyra was now more confused than ever, but she met the girl's eyes for the first time. It was hard to look at her with Cassiopeia, poor Cassiopeia, lying dead at her feet between them. Who would come to collect her body? Who would bundle her up for burning? "Who made you?" "What?" the girl whispered. "Who made you?" Lyra repeated. She'd never heard of other places like Haven, and she felt a small stirring of hope, as if a heavy locked door in her chest had just been unlatched. Maybe there were places for them to go, after all, places where there were people to take care of them like they'd been cared for at Haven, places with high walls to keep everyone else out.
I don't understand,
the girl said. Her eyes were so wide Lyra could see a whole portion of the night sky reflected in them. "You're a replica," Lyra said impatiently. The girl was slow, much slower than Cassiopeia, but she knew that this wasn't uncommon. She thought of Lilac Springs, dead now, probably, and 101, who'd never even learned how to hold a fork. She wondered how many of the others had burned.
"A what?" the girl whispered.
"A replica," Lyra repeated. The girl shook her head. Where she came from, they must be called something different. She recited, "An organism descended from or genetically identical to a single common ancestor?"
"A clone," the girl said, staring at Lyra so fixedly she was reminded of being under the observation lights and looked away.
"She means a clone, Jake,"
Yeah, well, I kind of already had that impression, the boy said, and he made a face as if he was offended by the sight of Cassiopeia's body. Lyra had the sudden urge to reach down and close Cassiopeia's eyes and wasn't sure where it had come from, maybe something one of the nurses had said about the way people buried one another. In Haven, the dead replicas had always simply been burned or dumped.
But it's impossible! The girl's voice had gotten very shrill. It's impossible! The technology doesn't exist! It's illegal!
Lyra lost patience. The girl was either suffering from side effects or she was very, very stupid to begin with. Failure to thrive.
It's not impossible, she said. At Haven, there were thousands of replicas.
Jesus! The boy closed his eyes. His face was like a second moon, pale and glowing.
Clones. It all makes sense now. Are you crazy? Nothing makes sense.
The girl had turned away, covering her mouth with her hand again, as if she was trying to force back the urge to be sick.
There's a dead girl with my face on her. We're standing here in the middle of the fucking night, and these people are telling me that there are clones running around out there. Thousands of them.
Gemma, calm down, okay? Everyone needs to calm down. The boy spoke loudly, even though the girl was the only one who wasn't calm, or the only one who was showing it, at least.
Can you put that thing down, please?
This was to 72, still holding the knife. We're not going to hurt you. Suddenly, Lyra was hit with a wave of dizziness. She went into a crouch and put her head between her knees. Her head was full of a hot and sticky darkness, a swirling that reminded her of heavy clouds of circulating gnats.
What's the matter with her?
She heard the girl's voice, but distantly. If 72 responded, she didn't hear him.
Hey.
A minute later, the girl was next to her. Are you okay? She put a hand on Lyra's back, and Lyra jerked away. She was used to being touched, manipulated, even opened up with knives and needles, but this felt different. Intimate and almost shameful, like when she'd first been caught by Nurse Don't Even Think About It in the bathroom with her hands submerged in bleach, trying to scrub her first period blood from her underwear. She couldn't speak. She was afraid that if she opened her mouth, she would throw up. The girl stood up again and moved away from her. And Lyra almost regretted jerking away, but she didn't want to be touched by strangers. Not anymore. Not if she could help it. Except... she remembered falling asleep, exhausted on the ground, the way the stars had blurred into a single bright point, leading her into sleep. She hadn't minded when 72 put his arms around her for warmth, but she was in shock, exhausted. She had needed the body heat. The world outside was too big. It was nice to feel bounded by something.
Maybe she's hungry,
the boy said. She wasn't hungry, but she stayed quiet. The worst of the nausea had released her, though. Strange how it came like that in dizzying rushes, like getting hit in the head. She sat back, too exhausted to stand again. She was no longer afraid, either. It was obvious that the strangers weren't there to hurt them or to take them anywhere. Now she just wished they would move on. She didn't understand the girl who was a replica but didn't know it. She didn't understand the boy who was with her and how they were related. 72 took a quick step forward.
You have food?
The boy looked to Cassiopeia's genotype, and she made a quick, impatient gesture with her hand. He shrugged out of his backpack and squatted to unzip it. Lyra had never had the chance to observe two males so close together and noticed he moved differently from 72. His movements were slow, as if his whole body hurt. 72 moved with a quickness that seemed like an attack.
Sorry, we didn't bring much.
72 came forward cautiously. He snatched up a granola bar and a bottle of water and then backtracked quickly. 72 tore open the granola bar with his teeth, spitting out the wrapper and began to eat. He kept his eyes on the boy, Jake, the whole time. And Lyra knew that he was worried the boy might try to take it back from him, but Jake only watched him. 72 opened the water, drank half of it, and then passed it to Lyra without removing his eyes from Jake.
Drink, he said. You'll feel better.
She hadn't realized how raw her throat felt until she drank, washing away some of the taste of ash and burning. She wished that Jake and Cassiopeia's replica would leave so that she could go back to sleep. At the same time, she was worried about what the morning would bring when they found themselves alone on the marshes again, with no food, nothing to drink, nowhere to go. "Look," the boy was talking to Lyra. Maybe he'd decided she was easier to talk to. Maybe he hadn't forgotten that 72 had a knife. "I know you must be tired. You've been through... I don't even know what you've been through."
"Jake," Cassiopeia's replica pressed her hand to her eyes.
"They've been living in Haven, Gemma," the boy said quickly. "My father died for this. I need to know."
"Father." The word sent a curious tremor up Lyra's spine, as if she'd been tapped between her vertebrae.
So Lyra was right about him. He was natural born.
"Jake, no."
Cassiopeia's replica. The boy had said her name was Gemma. Lyra remembered now, looked and sounded like one of the nurses.
Jake fell silent. "I don't believe you," she said. "I literally don't believe you. These poor people have been through God knows what. They're starving and cold, and they have no place to go, and you want to interview them?"
"I don't want to interview them. I want to understand."
Lyra took another sip of water, swallowing despite the pain. "Not people," she said, because the girl had been nice to them and she thought it was worth correcting her.
Gemma turned to stare at Lyra.
"What?" "We're not people," Lyra said. "You said these poor people have been through God knows what, but we're replicas. God didn't make us, Dr. Saperstein did. He's our God."
She stopped herself from pointing out that Gemma, too, must have been made by someone, even if she didn't know it. Gemma kept staring until Lyra finally felt uncomfortable and looked down at her hands. Had she said the wrong thing again? But she was just reciting what she knew to be true, what everyone had always told her. Finally, Gemma spoke again. Her voice was much softer now.
"We should camp here for the night," she said.
For an instant, she even sounded like Dr. O'Donnell.
"We'll go back to Wally in the morning."
"We're not going anywhere with you,"
72 said quickly. Lyra was surprised to hear him say "we." She had never been a "we." Maybe he'd only confused the word the way she still confused "I" and "it" sometimes.
"No,"
Gemma said. "No, you don't have to go with us, not unless you want to."
"Why would we want to?"
72 asked. In the dark, he was all hard angles, like someone hacked out of shadow. Now Lyra wasn't sure whether he was ugly or not. His face kept changing, and every time the light fell on it differently, he looked like a new person. Cassiopeia's replica didn't blink.
"You can't plan on staying here forever. You have no money, no ID. You're not even supposed to exist, and there will be people looking for you."
The girl was right. You're not even supposed to exist. Lyra knew the truth of these words, even though she wasn't sure exactly what they meant. Hadn't that been the point of the guards and the fences, to keep the replicas safe and secret and protected? Everyone who had known them had despised them. "You're not supposed to exist." Wasn't that what the nurses were always saying? That they were monsters and abominations? All except Nurse M, all those years ago, and Dr. O'Donnell. But both of them had gone away. Everyone went away in the end.
"Can I have more water?"
she asked. And so somehow it was decided. 72 turned to look at her with an expression she couldn't read, but she was too tired to worry about him and what he thought and whether they were making the right decision. Neither of the strangers wanted to sleep near Cassiopeia's body, so they moved instead through the thick patch of hobble-back trees and tall grasses streaked with bird guano, leaving the corpse behind. Lyra didn't understand it. She liked being near to Cassiopeia's body. It was comforting. She could imagine she was back at Haven, even, that she and Cassiopeia were just lying in separate cots across the narrow space that divided them. Gemma, the girl, suggested she try a soda. Lyra had never had soda before. At Haven, the vending machines were for the staff only, although sometimes the nurses took pity on the younger replicas and gave them coins from the vending machines to play with, to roll or flip or barter. Her first impression was that it was much, much too sweet. But she felt better after a few sips. Less nauseous. Her hands were steadier, too. Gemma found a clean sweatshirt in the bottom of Jake's bag and offered it to 72, but he refused. So instead Lyra took it, though it was far too big and she did nothing but pull it on over the filth of her regular shirt. She was warm now, but she was also comforted by the feel of clean cotton and the smell of it, like the laundry detergent they used at Haven that sent the sheets back stiff and crisp as paper. This sweatshirt wasn't stiff, but soft. So soft. She curled up on the ground and 72 sat next to her.
"I don't trust them,"
he whispered, looking over to where the boy and girl were making camp, arguing over who should be allowed to use the backpack as a pillow.
"They're not like us."
"No," she said. Her tongue felt thick. Her mind felt thick, too, as if it had also been blanketed in cotton. She wanted to say, "We don't exist." She wanted to say, "We have no choice." But even as she reached for the words, the cord tethering her thoughts snapped, and she was bobbing, wordless, mindless, into the dark. It seemed she'd barely fallen asleep before she was jerked into awareness again by movement beside her. She sat up and saw 72 half on his feet with the knife in his hand. The girl Gemma was standing above them, and for a confused second, before the clutch of dream fully released her, Lyra again mistook her for Cassiopeia and felt a leap of feeling she had no name for. "It's okay," the girl said. "It's just me, Gemma, remember?" 72 lowered his knife. Lyra thought he must have been having a bad dream. He looked pale. They'd woken up very close together, side by side again. She wondered whether he'd reached for her again in the middle of the night, for body heat. A person's average body temperature fell during sleep, she knew, sometimes by a full degree, another thing she had heard and remembered. "There are still men on the island," Gemma said immediately. "They're burning what's left of Haven."
"You saw them? You got close?"
The other one, Jake, had woken too. He stood up, shoving a hand through his hair. Lyra had always been fascinated by hair. She and the other replicas had their scalps shaved every week and was temporarily mesmerized by the way it fell.
"You should have woken me. It's not safe."
Lyra barely heard him. She stood too, despite the fact that her legs felt gelatinous and uncertain. The sky was getting light. "What do you mean they're burning what's left of Haven?"
"Just what I said," Gemma said.
Lyra had a sudden explosion of memories. The smell of the stew pot in the morning and the way the sunlight patterned the linoleum, the courtyard path splotched with guano, the medicinal smell of a swab on her arm, the pinch of a needle, a voice murmuring she would be okay, okay. All her friends, squeeze me and thermoscan and even the glass eyes, who could never entirely be trusted, all of them gone. Lyra's memories felt right then like physical things punching up into her consciousness. The small cot with her number fixed to the steel headboard, shower heads arrayed in a row and the smell of soap-scented steam and the echo of dozens of voices, laundry day and trash day and the mournful bellow of the departing barges, even the things she hated, paper cups filled with pills and vitamins, the nurses sneering at the replicas, or worse, acting as though they were afraid. Still, Haven was home. It was where she belonged.
"Then there's no going back?"
She hadn't realized, fully realized, until the words were out of her mouth, that on some level she had been holding on to the idea that this would all pass. The explosions and the fire and the soldiers shouting, "Stop!" saying, "You know how expensive these things are to make?" All of it would be explained. Then they would be herded up. They would be returned to Haven, 72 included. They would be evaluated by doctors, the nurses would distribute pills, the prim white hush-hush for pain, the slightly larger sleepers that made the world relax into fog. Everything would return to normal.
"There's no going back,"
72 said. He wasn't as hard with her as he'd been the day before. Lyra wondered if it was because he felt sorry for her.
I told you that. They'll kill us if they find us, one way or another. They'll kill us.
Lyra turned away. She wouldn't listen. The guards and soldiers were trained to kill. And she had never liked the doctors or the nurses, the researchers or the birthers with their incomprehensible speech, but she knew that Haven had existed to protect them, that the doctors were trying to keep them safe against the cancers that exploded through the tissue of their lungs and livers and brains, against the diseases that reversed the normal processes of life and made food go up instead of down or lungs drown in fluid of their own creation. Side effects. The replication process was still imperfect. If it weren't for the doctors, Lyra and 72 would have died years ago as infants, like so many replicas had, like the whole yellow crop did. She remembered all those tiny bodies bundled carefully in paper sheaths, each of them no bigger than a loaf of bread, hundreds of them borne away on the barge to be burned in the middle of the ocean.
We have to get off the marshes. There will be new patrols now that it's light. They'll be looking for survivors.
Gemma was speaking in a low voice, the kind of voice Lyra associated with the nurses when they wanted something. Calm down. Deep breath. Just a little burn. Come with us, and we'll get you clothes and hide you someplace no one will be looking for you. Then you can figure out where to go. We can figure it out. Okay? Lyra said. Because 72 had just opened his mouth, and she was tired of being spoken for, tired of letting him decide for her. He wasn't a doctor. He had no right to tell her what to do. But she had followed him, and she had to make the best of it. Besides, she didn't think Gemma wanted to hurt them, though she couldn't have said why. Maybe only because Gemma was Cassiopeia's replica, although she knew that was stupid. Genotypes often had different personalities. Number 120 had tried to suffocate her own genotype while she slept because she wanted to be the real one, the only one. Cassiopeia was nice to Lyra, but Calliope liked to kill things. She had once killed a bird while Lyra was watching, and 121 had never spoken a single word. Okay, we'll go with you, she said a little louder when 72 turned to look at her. She was pleased when he didn't argue. Felt a little stronger, a little more in control. Cassiopeia's replica would help them. They needed to know what had happened to Haven and why. Then they could figure out what to do next. Jake and Gemma had come on a boat called a kayak. Lyra had never seen one before and didn't especially want to ride in it, but there was no choice. Gemma and Jake would have to go on foot, and there might be places so deep they'd have to swim. Neither 72 nor Lyra had ever learned to swim, and she nearly asked him what he had meant by trying to escape Haven, how he'd expected to survive. When she was little, she had sometimes dreamed of escape, dreamed of going home on the launches with one of the staff members, being dressed and cared for and cuddled. But she had learned better, had folded that need down inside of her, stored it away. Otherwise, she knew she might go crazy, like so many of the other replicas who'd chosen to die or tried to sneak out on the trash barges with the nurses and been killed by exhaust in the engine room. Once again, she wondered if 72 was just a little bit crazy. Being in the kayak felt like being on a narrow, extremely wobbly gurney. The seat was wet. Her stomach lurched as 72 shoved the kayak into the shallows and then clambered in himself, refusing Jake's help. She couldn't believe they didn't just sink. She was uncomfortably aware of the sloshing of the water below her, which seemed to be attempting to jettison her out of her seat. She was afraid to move, afraid even to breathe. But miraculously, the kayak stayed afloat, and 72 soon got the hang of paddling. The muscles in his arms and shoulders stood out when he moved, and Lyra found him unexpectedly beautiful to watch. She began to relax, despite the painful slowness of their progress and the continued rhythm of motorboats in the distance, and the ripples from their wakes that sent water sloshing into the kayak. She should be afraid. She didn't know much about feelings, but she knew that Gemma was afraid, and Jake was afraid, and even 72 was afraid. But for some reason, for a short time, the fear released her. She was floating, gliding toward a new life. She had never thought she'd know what it felt like to be out on the water, had never imagined that a life outside Haven could exist. The outside world, constantly visible to her through the fence, had nonetheless seemed like the soap operas she sometimes saw on the nurse's TV. Pretty to look at, but essentially unreal. But the novelty soon wore off. The insects were thick. Gnats swarmed them in mists. They hardly seemed to be moving. Tendrils of floating grass made certain roots impassable and had to be manually separated or threshed aside with a paddle. Several times Gemma lost her footing in the water and nearly went under. Lyra wondered how long they would be able to go, whether they would make it. She wondered whether they would have to leave Gemma behind and thought of Cassiopeia lying in the reeds while the sun burned away her retinas. She felt a momentary regret, but didn't know why. Death was natural. Decay, too. It was another thing that made replicas in humans similar. They died. Finally, Gemma called them to a stop. Lyra was relieved for the break and the chance to get off the water, especially now that the mid-morning sun was like an exposed eye. They'd barely dragged the kayak out of the water when Jake yelled, "Get down!" The hum of an approaching helicopter suddenly doubled, tripled in volume. Lyra's breath was knocked away by its pressure. They went into a crouch beneath the fat sprawl of a mangrove tree as the helicopter roared by overhead. The whole ground trembled. Marsh grass lay flat beneath the wind threshed from the helicopter's giant rotor. Looking up through the branches, Lyra saw a soldier leaning out of the open door to point at something on the horizon. Then the helicopter was gone. They left the kayak behind and went the rest of the way on foot. The ground was soft and wet, and they had to wade through tidal pools where the mud was studded with sharp-toothed clams and splinters of broken shells. The growth here was different, the trees taller and less familiar to Lyra. She felt as if they were moving deep in an undiscovered wilderness and was shocked when instead Gemma gave a cry of relief and the trees opened up to reveal a small dirt clearing, corroded metal trash bins, and various signs she was too tired to read. "Thank God," Gemma said. Lyra watched as Jake moved to a dusty car parked in the lot and loaded his backpack into it. She was afraid all over again. She knew about cars because she'd seen them on TV, and Lazy Ass was always complaining about hers, piece of shit, but she didn't think she wanted to ride in one, especially since, according to Lazy Ass's stories, at least, cars were always breaking down or leaking oil or giving trouble in some way. But once again, they had no choice. And at the very least, being in the car felt better, sturdier than being in the kayak. Although as soon as Jake began bumping down the road, Lyra had to close her eyes to keep from being sick. But this only made things worse. The car was louder, too, than she thought it would be. The windows rattled and the engine sounded like a wild animal, and the radio was so loud Lyra thought her head would explode. They were going so fast that the outside world looked blurry, and she had to close her eyes again. To calm herself, she recited the alphabet in her head, then counted up from 1 to 100. She listed all the constellations she knew, but that was painful. She imagined Cassiopeia's face and Ursa Major's obsession with hoarding things from the mess hall, old spoons and paper cups, bags of oyster crackers and packages of mustard, and wondered whether she would ever see any of the other replicas again. "Hey, are you all right? It's okay, we're stopped now." Lyra opened her eyes and saw that Gemma was right. They had stopped. They were in what looked like an enormous loading dock, but filled with dozens and dozens of parked cars instead of boats. A parking lot. Another idea she'd absorbed from the nurses without ever having seen it. Could all the cars belong to different people? Looming in the distance was a building 3 times the size of even the box. WALMART. Lyra flexed her fingers, which ached. She had been holding tight to her seat without realizing it. "You guys can stay here, okay?" Gemma said. "Just sit tight. We're going to buy food and stuff and clothes," she added. "Do you know your shoe size?" Lyra shook her head. At Haven, they were provided with sandals or slippers,
Sometimes they were too big, other times too small, but Lyra so often went barefoot she hadn't thought it mattered.
Okay, Gemma exhaled. What did you say your names were again?
I'm Lyra, Lyra said, and this is 72.
She was distracted.
Outside the car, Jake was speaking on a cell phone. Lyra felt a twinge of nervousness. Who was he calling? Every so often he glanced back into the car as if to make sure that Lyra and 72 were still there. What if 72 was right, and Jake and Gemma couldn't be trusted?
72? Gemma repeated. That isn't a name.
It's my number, 72 said shortly.
I'm 24,
Lyra said by way of explanation, but one of the doctors named me.